This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it, and I find myself staying up late to catch all the action. I can't be dragging the next morning. That's why I go for a 5-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or when my favorite team is playing late. With over 15 flavors to choose from, like watermelon, tropical burst, blue raspberry, peach mango, and more, there's a flavor for everyone. On their website, you have the option to build your own 12-pack or 24-pack and have it delivered right to your door. And if you're out and about, you can always pick up a 5-hour energy shot at your local grocery or convenience store. They're everywhere. 5-hour energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before the next tip-off.
Survivor 48 is here, and alongside it, we're bringing you a brand new season of On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. If you're a Survivor super fan, you won't want to miss this deep dive into every episode where we break down how we designed the game, the biggest moves, your burning questions. It's the only podcast that gives you inside access to Survivor that nobody else can. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast with me, Jeff Probst, every Wednesday after the show, wherever you get your podcasts.
So, folks, we've seen the repeated attempts to cancel and silence those with positions contrary to our own, and this is really an attack on one of our founding principles, free speech. So the question really is how do we encourage civil discourse as it relates to controversial topics when we're having these conversations? Alan Carey, director of Sphere Education Initiatives at the Cato Institute, joins us to talk about this. He's been in town for several days addressing groups and teachers and the like as to how to go about engaging in a proper civil discourse as it relates to these controversial topics. And he's also a presenter at the New Orleans Book Fest on 40 cities that change the world. That's this afternoon today at Tulane. I think at 3 o'clock is his presentation. Alan, welcome to the show.
Noel, thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
Alan, I wanted to see your presentation at Newman the other night, and something came up at the last moment. I wasn't able to do so because I find this to be a very troubling time in our country today, where we just can't have rational conversations any longer about controversial topics.
Yeah, that's right. It's gotten to be particularly challenging, in large part because the problem of polarization is driving us all apart. It makes it hard to see the humanity in people who disagree, and often it leads us to do things like think they're more extreme than they happen to be. We happen to have this nasty tendency now, because of that measure of polarization, to say, well, if they think differently than me, they must not only think different than me, they must be so extremely different than me, and there's not really anything worth their learning or talking about.
So how do you create the framework to have this more civil discourse on these controversial topics?
Absolutely. I think, like many of these kinds of things, the best place you can begin is thinking about what's some steps that I can take as an individual to help things go right. So when you're in that environment, one of the things that really helps, right, lower the temperature, decrease the likelihood that people get worked up in unproductive ways, is ask more questions than demand answers, right? So what I mean by that is, if someone says something, you're not sure how you feel about it, spend a little bit of time first asking them more. Tell me a little bit more about what you think. Just about the most powerful thing you can say in a situation like that. But once you've got that, the second thing that can go really far is doing them the kind of courtesy of saying, have I really represented your argument well? So doing things like, here's what I'm hearing you saying, is that right? Or what am I missing? What are the kinds of things that are really important shaping your thinking about this issue? That in turn shows that, frankly, you respect them, right? And when we respect the other person, they're that much more likely to be interested in hearing your way of thinking. They'll ask you questions. They'll engage, not always, but a heck of a lot more often than normal.
What do you do, like, I've been an educator in my past life, and a lot of times when you're talking about a controversial topic, it begins with an attack on what, you know, the teacher's position may be, as opposed to a presentation of where their thinking lies.
A lot of our work, what we do with Sphere, is really working with teachers. It's really setting the stage to say part of the biggest opportunity in front of us is working with young people and help them get better at it. But as you rightly point out, it's so often challenging as an educator to be in that environment and help it go correctly. So what can you do in that environment? I think a couple of things. One, even before getting into those controversial issues, the most important thing that happens in that space is creating room and norms around conversation. Like, have a classroom where conversation and topics and all people being involved is a really common practice. So they get good at it, they get used to the ability of having those conversations without assuming the worst or attacking each other. And then as you start to introduce those more challenging conversations, you can do the kind of things that says, all right, well, what we're going to do, great tactic that I love encouraging, is a sort of debate-centered approach to education. So that is, you know what the topic is in advance, you know that you're going to need to be responsible for presenting a side, but you don't know which side you're going to be presenting. So you ask the students, come in prepared, well, be ready to talk about both, because you're not going to know until you get there who it is. And then when you're in that environment, they really need to take seriously, well, what are the different perspectives? How do we think about that? And no, it's not a teacher articulating a point of view. It's students bringing in that broad diversity of perspectives.
A little bit of a touch of the Socratic method, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, it's interesting, and I'm sure you see this all the time, and because you work with teachers a lot. We seem to communicate in sound bites now. Right. Just little tiny bits of information. And when you ask for examples or an analogy or something to backfill that soundbite, it's like nothing. There's nothing there. Mm-hmm. And the conversation just, it can't go any further than the soundbite from, you know, it becomes very one-sided of someone who may know something about the issue as opposed to the person that's challenging and just utilizing sound bites.
Yeah, absolutely. So we do a lot of work with some of our programming in the summer with teachers where we use a method called the intellectual Turing test. So built off of the old, like, can an AI trick a human into thinking it might be real, right? That Turing test idea. The intellectual Turing test is a really neat version where instead of getting into it directly and making your case, both sides get into it by beginning to make the case for the other side. So if I walk in and I say, Newell, here's what I would think I would make the argument that you might say on this issue as if you were making it. You in turn do the same for my position. And what that does is it forces us to, one, really understand not just our own side of the case, but the other, but be able to articulate it in a way that really shows that kind of thoughtfulness and respect for the other side. But that requires you to get a little bit more of that information out. And you can do the same thing with students. And this is one of the things that works really well. It's thinking about how you can get people in the position really used to the idea of asking the question, hey, what's the best case to be made that you might be wrong? What gives you pause? And that puts people into being in a position to be a little bit more humble, even when they know a lot about their own side. And that helps overcome some of that soundbite, like that one-sidedness that we tend to see.
We're visiting with Alan Carey, Director of Sphere Education Initiatives at the Cato Institute. In your conversations with educators today, what do they articulate as one of the most challenging things facing them in the classroom, you know, along the lines of what we've been talking about?
Yeah. I think there's a couple of really big pieces that are tough. When we first started doing this work with Sphere, one of the things that informed our decision-making was that a lot of educators have been concerned about precisely some of the challenges you're talking about, one-sidedness in the conversation or students having an inability to have these hard conversations. But the teachers themselves were a little bit worried about, how can I have these conversations when maybe that is an area that I know a lot about myself? So part of what we do is we bring experts together from different ideological backgrounds to help support teachers to, understand a little bit more about how lots of different people think about these issues. But the other big piece that we see, and we hear a lot from teachers, is that, they're concerned. They're concerned about being able to have real and meaningful conversations in the classroom because of misperceptions about what they're doing or what they're trying to do, or challenges where they're worried if they have a hard conversation and maybe a student reports it back to a family or community member who takes what they said the wrong way, they're still going to have a job if they do that. So there's some really interesting survey work that's come out recently that said something like about 65% of teachers are self-censoring in the classroom. Not about things that are inappropriate to a classroom conversation, but about the kinds of topics and areas that are age level appropriate, content appropriate for their students. And that gives us a lot of pause.
Do you find that students really fail in understanding what is subjective versus objective?
I wouldn't say just students. I think a lot of us adults are doing a poor job as well. But I think that's right. Yeah, I think there's a pretty pervasive sense in which for a lot of us, when we're in that polarized environment, we take a look at any information and we say, well, we look at it just through the lens that we're coming from, just through an ideology or just through a perspective that says, well, this justifies this or it's excusable because of that, instead of saying, well, what's the information actually tell us, and then form an opinion about it second. And that's a tough challenge, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, especially when the conversation starts with, I feel. And you try to dig behind that as to what's driving that feelings, those feelings, and it's more of the response being, well, I feel. Well, yeah, I got that, but that's subjective. I'm trying to get to what's happening objectively that's driving your subjective feelings.
And absolutely.
And a lot of times there's this, like, the deer in the headlight look, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will say, having spent this whole week going in and visiting with students at schools all across New Orleans, it's just an exceptional group of students. So they're doing a fantastic job on this margin. But for a lot of us, right, students included, that's precisely right. We're in a tough spot where it says it's safer to begin by saying I have an emotion because, well, that's my emotion and you can't respond to that, instead of saying, here's the argument I'm making, and, standing up for your position, taking a case and making some support for it, and then engaging with people who think and argue differently than you do. That's a riskier place to be.
You know, this notion of canceling and attempting to silence folks, it's a very disturbing thing to me. I was educated in a Catholic school education and schools that very much deployed the Socratic method of challenging, individuals to support their position, bring the data, bring the information behind it. And it just seems as though the art of the debate is really kind of a lost today in many respects.
I think that's right. Yes, there's a significant sense in which we have a long way to go to reteach some of those core approaches to engaging and thinking about differences, but also, like you said, making a case, make a debate, really be out front of what you hope to be sharing with others, and knowing that when people push back on you, it's not a personal attack on who you are as a person. It's engaging with an idea. You're making a recommendation about how you think the world should be. And that's an important thing for other people to have a say in, have a go.
Do you find that people are more easily offended today? I mean, is that kind of the sense that you get?
You know, it's tough to measure it across time. I will say there's a there's power in being able to say you don't get to push back on me because that's just my opinion or this is my feeling or sometimes you hear it in, expressed in phrases like this is my lived experience, in which case push back looks like attacking their identity, right, as opposed to engaging the argument. And I think that's a significant concern. But as the you know, you'd mentioned a bit ago that challenge around cancel culture, and I think there's a really great model here of the argument that Frederick Douglass makes. So he's got this great speech in Boston in the 1860s about free speech. He's pushing back on mob violence and a whole variety of issues. He says, in effect, violating the right to speech, right, that kind of cancellation, is a double harm, right? It's a harm to the right of the person speaking, but also to the right of the person listening, right? And that's, I think, a really important point that we keep missing, right? We're missing the hearer, right? We're missing the right of the person to hear points of view that they want to engage with that might be different than what you think.
You know, it's interesting. I read a piece that you did on called The Last Word, The Lost Art of Disagreeing. And one of the observations that you make is that, you know, finding the points of common ground. And interestingly, more often than not, the common ground, if you were to break it up into a percentage of the conversation, is far greater than where you disagree, more often than not.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a spot-on observation. We have, again, it goes back to this measure of polarization. The more we're divided, the more we think we don't have anything in common. And it turns out is that most Americans, most of the time, agree on an awful lot. And so as we're having those conversations, if we're going right to those spots where we say, here's the crux of our heated argument, we miss, you know, 6, 7 tenths of the case where we're pretty close, where we care about a lot of the same things and agree about a lot of the same issues.
I have an idea that our political discourse is driving this wedge amongst folks, because it's all we see on the news, right? And it's what we hear in podcasts. And almost everywhere you go to get information, the political discourse is driving the thought process in this country. And it is so divisive right now. I mean, it's almost on minute-by-minute wins to make one side look bad and the other side look good.
I think that's right. There's a tremendous amount of ill will that gets built up precisely because of what you're talking about. It is a series of gotcha moments or trolling behavior or pushing people to make them look foolish or take them out of context. It's constantly we've got to win each moment, and each moment gets shorter and shorter and shorter. And that kind of discourse leads to, well, frankly, really ineffective engagements. It leads to a kind of hatred for other people or an unwillingness to engage in even the most basic forms of conversation necessary to make our republic work. And I think until we can fix some of those pieces, might change the incentive structure around rewarding people for their bad behavior in those sorts of ways, we're not going to get very far.
We're visiting with Alan Carey, Director of Sphere Education Initiatives at the Cato Institute. Alan, have we lost the art of listening?
We certainly have, yeah. I unfortunately live just outside of Washington, D.C., and one of the things that's most challenging about many of my fellow residents of that part of the country is that we're particularly bad when it comes to listening at all. Usually it's a measure of listening to wait your turn to talk at the other person. And that's not getting us anywhere. And part of that problem is it's needing to assert yourself or show your importance or how it engages. But even more generally, we're getting a little bit more isolated and a little less likely to have conversation with people who think differently. And that's why I think it's so important that we encourage people to really begin with that measure of listening, listening to understand. There was a couple of schools I was at this week here in New Orleans where they've developed civil discourse statements and freedom of expression work in the school, and consistent across each of those is this idea of we have to begin with listening. We have to begin with a kind of curiosity. And if we don't have that kind of curiosity, we're missing out both in the ability for ourselves to learn, but also to really see each other, to really engage with each other in a way that allows some of this divisiveness to fall away.
Yeah, you know, conversations today, they don't always have to be about winning. I've often said that learning is probably the most single most important thing of any day of my life, is learning something new. And the only way you can go about doing that is by listening.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Surrounding yourself with people smarter than you and listening and engaging in conversation, right? You know, and being challenged. I mean, the way that you improve and you create a higher intellectual level for oneself is to be challenged each and every day, and to engage with folks that are a hell of a lot smarter than you are. And the recognition, I think, a lot of times that folks fall prey to is that you're not the center of any universe. It's not
about
you. You know, it's like, and I don't know, I just feel like we've completely got all disjointed at some point in time on this timeline of our country. As you point out, 250 years, an opportunity to evaluate the importance of our basic freedom of speech and freedom of conscience.
I think that's right. Yeah. I love your point there. There's a kind of humility that we tend to miss. Are we... We're so confident that we're right about everything. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I've spent an awful lot of my time wrong about a whole bunch of different things that I look back on and say, wow, I could have been a lot better there. I could have learned from the people around me. And I think that kind of humility is incredibly important. And I love that the anniversary of the Declaration of Independence gives us this opportunity to look around us and say, well, what can we learn from the founders? Where did they get this right?
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt about it. Alan Carey, Director of Sphere Education Initiatives at the Cato Institute. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great, and thank you for coming down for New Orleans Book Fest as well. The lineup there is incredible, and Alan's going to be talking about 40 cities that changed the world. I was looking at some of the information behind that topic. I wish I could be there. It looks very, very interesting and intriguing, but best of luck to you.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thanks to your fellow citizens here in New Orleans. It's been a great week.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back, 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us.